From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The next 11 minutes of this broadcast will be difficult to hear. This country is caught in a vicious cycle of violence that we cannot seem to escape. We woke up this morning to yet another mass shooting, this time in Indianapolis, where at least 8 people were killed at a FedEx warehouse near the Indianapolis airport. It happened on the same day we saw yet another video of someone dying at the hands of police, this time in Chicago. This time, a 13-year-old boy named Adam Toledo.
We will have the latest on both of those stories, starting first with WFYI reporter Taylor Bennett in Indianapolis. Welcome, Taylor.
Thank you.
City officials there gave an update on the investigation this morning during a press conference. Here's Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett.
Nothing we learn can heal the wounds of those who escaped with their lives, but who will now bear the scars and endure the memories of this horrific crime. What we are left with this morning is grief.
Taylor, the police chief and FBI special agent in charge, Paul Keenan, also spoke. What's the latest that these two shared about this investigation?
Well, it is very early in the investigation, but what we do know and what they did say at the press conference this morning was that this mass shooting took place just after 11 o'clock last night. Police say that officers arrived at the scene and they found the 8 bodies. 5 victims, they say with injuries that were consistent with gunshot wounds, were transported to local hospitals for treatment. I know at least 2 victims were treated at the scene and released. And then they say that, according to a preliminary investigation, is that the alleged shooter took his own life at the scene. No officers were injured, and police were still working to identify those victims and notify their families. I know they did say that, witnesses have reported that the gunman started shooting after getting out of his car, and then he entered the building.
What do investigators know about the suspect, the suspect's identity and motive?
Yeah, they said they couldn't release any information about the suspect or a motive. Again, according to witnesses, they saw this guy get out of his car, started shooting, and then went into the building and started shooting again. So they really could not release any information on the alleged shooter or the victims.
We saw the images of more than 100 people gathering at a nearby hotel last night, awaiting information about their loved ones who worked at that warehouse. You mentioned there were several folks who were injured. Some folks have been released from the hospital. What can you tell us so far about the 8 victims? Were they employees of FedEx? What additional information at all have authorities been able to give you on that part of this investigation?
Right. Yeah, they really didn't release any information on the victims at all. Now, what we do know is that some families were waiting for information about their loved ones that were inside. They say that employees were barred from having cell phones with them when they worked, so they couldn't call their loved ones inside to find out if they were okay. And I know that created a lot of frustration at the scene with family members. But yeah, they were still on the scene. They were trying to get some more information. And I don't think they still have that information to know if their loved ones are okay yet.
This is the 3rd mass shooting in the Indianapolis area so far this year. The mayor said just last week that he had joined 150 mayors across America and signed a letter to the U.S. Senate asking to consider legislation around background checks. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, he did mention that. And, you know, it is the 3rd mass shooting in the city since January. 5 people, including a pregnant woman, they were shot and killed in January. And then a man was accused of killing, 3 people and abducted a child during an argument last month. So this has created a lot of frustration, I know, for city officials, local and state leaders, even lawmakers. They've all been responding today, expressing, shock and sadness over this. And we had a city council member issue a statement, and she was calling on lawmakers at the State House, who only have really a few days left in session, to talk about gun violence more, look at passing background check legislation, banning automatic rifles and just advocating for really some other common sense gun control measures. But again, lawmakers are about ready to wrap up their session. And I don't know if that's going to be done at the state level, though.
That's WFYI reporter Taylor Bennett in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for this update, Taylor.
You are welcome.
All right, let's go now to Chicago for a reaction to the newly released police video that shows an officer shooting 13-year-old Adam Toledo in an alley early in the morning on March 29th. Chip Mitchell is covering the story for member station WBEZ. He is the criminal justice reporter there. Chip, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And we're going to get to that video in just a moment, but first, how does it feel in Chicago right now?
Well, a couple things. There is a lot of sorrow. It's very, very hard to see the video of this 13-year-old boy getting shot and his life ending. It's probably the most poignant video of a police shooting maybe that we've ever had. So there's a lot of people are just in mourning. There's also, of course, a lot of tension. Last night, after the city released the materials, including the body cam footage, there were some small protests, but they were a lot smaller than what we've seen after other shootings, and including a lot of disturbances after the George Floyd incident last year and looting on many occasions. Where the neighborhood in the neighborhood where the shooting took place, though, people were calm, and it was mainly sorrow, stopping by and leaving candles, flowers, and crosses. There's another protest planned for tonight. A lot of groups are signing on, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. We knew police video existed, but we didn't see it until yesterday. Did we learn anything from it? Did it answer any questions?
Well, we did learn a lot. Officials had been hinting and saying all along that there was a gun involved. One of the materials released and presented yesterday afternoon, it was put together by the police department, and it freezes on a frame that does appear to show a gun in the boy's hand. The officer then, this is the body cam footage. You can hear the officer telling Adam, "Show me your hands," with an expletive in there. And then the boy complies. He stops and he raises his hands. The officer shoots a single round as the boy is raising his arms above his head. And the gun at that point does not appear to be the gun, the alleged gun. It doesn't appear to be in the boy's hand when he is shot with his hands up. But a police official, the chief of detectives, he said it was less than a second from when the gun could be seen in the boy's hand to when the officer shot him. Right after the shooting, then the officer can be heard radioing for an ambulance. He goes and checks in on the boy. And then about a minute later, officers are on the scene. They're arriving and they begin providing medical care to the boy. So that's very different from some past situations on video where, you know, such as the infamous case, Laquan McDonald, where the officers on the scene just stood around as Laquan's final moments and didn't help him at all. So in this case, the officer who shot him was actually giving him CPR. So we've seen some change, at least on that front here in Chicago.
Look, the Laquan McDonald video was awful. This video is awful. I mean, that's not even the right word to describe it. They're just horrifying to watch. And the point that you made about his hands were empty when he raised them, this is the point that the family's attorney is trying to make loud and clear. Here's Adina Weiss-Ortiz.
He tossed the gun. If he had a gun, he tossed it. The officer said, "Show me your hands." He complied. He turned around. There's a still photo going around on the internet with his hands up, and he shot in the middle of his chest.
So that is going to be the fundamental question, most likely, in this investigation. Why did the officer shoot if the boy had his hands in the air? He complied with the order. But in the meantime, what are we learning now about the officer who shot him? We know his name, Eric Stillman.
Yeah, his name's Eric Stillman, 34 years old. He was hired by the department in 2015, serves on a tactical team in the local police district. So he's not generally answering calls, you know, one after another after another. These are the teams that respond to shooting alerts. In this case, it was a shot spotter alert. These sound devices that pinpoint where gunfire comes from. It's not uncommon for members of these teams to be some of the more aggressive officers. They take in a lot of guns, and they are also often in high-stress situations. But these officers and this particular team, it was district-specific. We have 22 police districts, so they knew this neighborhood well. They're not some of the cops on teams that rove all across the city to hotspots. These are officers that know the neighborhood well. And I actually wanted to say a little bit more about the question of the focus of the investigation. It's not
just
going to be...
Sure, just briefly, please, if you could. Yeah.
Yes, it's not just going to be, we're hands up, was the gun in hand? It's going to be what the officer himself was experiencing and what was reasonable given what he was perceiving to do at that point.
Criminal justice reporter Chip Mitchell reporting for WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you very much for your time.
Good to be with you.
A government watchdog says planning and intelligence failures by Capitol Police contributed to the chaos and deadly violence when insurrectionists stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Inspector General Michael Bolton presented the findings of his investigation yesterday to the congressional committee that oversees the Capitol Police. Representative Zoe Lofgren chairs that committee. She's a Democrat and she joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
Yes, you called for this hearing after receiving a briefing from Bolton last month. What are your thoughts on his testimony, and what are the key takeaways for the American people?
Well, I thought his testimony was very helpful. There were obviously a lot of issues related to the insurrection, but his focus is only on one thing, the Capitol Police. The officers were not the focus of this report, but really the institution of the Capitol Police and how prepared they were. And there were very serious deficiencies that caused the police to be unable to protect the Capitol.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those deficiencies. In Bolton's report, he laid out that officers apparently said their protective gear was cumbersome and complained about aging riot shields that shattered upon impact. Bolton said most officers had not completed their required annual training for the last few years. And he said some of the agency's own intelligence indicated that Congress itself was a target. Why were they so unprepared?
There was a real management problem in the department and a real organizational problem. They received very credible and concrete information in December. It was never put together with other pieces of information, and they were not prepared and did not prepare for that type of event. In terms of equipment, astonishing part of the story was some shields that did work and should have been made available to the officers were stored off-site and in the end were brought over in a bus by civilians who worked for a different department. So this was not, they were not ready for prime time, and the officers on the front lines who were put out there with adequate equipment paid a terrible price, and the country paid a terrible price in watching these insurrectionists successfully breach the Capitol.
How much blame do you place on Capitol Police leadership?
Well, I think obviously we need to do a complete review. It's really a cultural change that we need to look at, not just a police department where a crime is committed, you respond, you arrest the perpetrator, but more like the Secret Service, preventing these instances to begin with. I mean, one of the things that I thought was astonishing was that there was less than lethal force equipment available, but the officers were told not to use it. And there was a specific, I don't mention the name, but an assistant deputy chief in the department who apparently was concerned that use of less than lethal weapons, somebody could get hurt. Well, hello, people died.
The ranking member on your committee, Republican Rodney Davis of Illinois, says part of the problem is that the Capitol Police are governed by the Capitol Police Board, which has political appointees. Do you agree with this?
Well, you know, I was concerned that the Republicans kept returning to the Capitol Police Board because the Inspector General said at the beginning, it's not within his jurisdiction and he hasn't studied it. So continuing to ask the IG about that, I think might have had a political purpose. There are some Republicans who somehow tried to blame Democrats for the Trump-induced riot, which is ridiculous. I don't believe they were operating in a political way at all. They were simply operating in a less than competent way. How we alter that is the question. And I don't think any of us has the magic answer yet. I know I do not.
Well, what is the next step, though, in instituting some of these changes that Bolton says basically are necessary to avoid any future incidents like what we saw on January 6th?
Well, we're going to continue our oversight. He's not through with his review, and he actually has another report that's due out at the end of this month. I'm in close contact with the chair of the House Appropriations Committee that also has some jurisdiction because they appropriate the funds to see how we transform this department.
That's Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, here in the western United States, we are locked in a severe drought. There is less snowpack in the mountains, wildfires are more intense, and the states that rely on the Colorado River are bracing for significant restrictions to their water supply. That explains why 8 western states are trying to shake more water out of the sky by using a technology known as cloud seeding. Chelsea Harvey covers climate science for E&E News. Chelsea, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So for a lot of people, I think this is going to be the first time that they've ever heard that you can coax a cloud to start raining or snowing. So why don't we start there? Explain how this works.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think not a lot of people have heard about this, which is interesting because it's a practice that's actually been going on for decades now. Basically, the way that it works is you can take this substance called silver iodide. It's a kind of a crushed up powder. It's a crystal-like substance, and you can spray it into the air so that it lands in clouds, and you can do this either using chimneys that are kind of sitting on the tops of mountains, or you can take a plane and actually fly it through the air, and this substance goes into the clouds and it attracts water droplets and they freeze into ice and basically produce snow.
Wow. So as you say, it's been used many years, but is it getting more common now that the drought seems to just keep going and going and going?
Yeah, I think there's definitely at least a lot more interest in it now as this drought continues and, you know, a lot more interest both from state governments and from private entities like ski resorts, you know, or power companies that want to increase precipitation for example, hydroelectric purposes. And, you know, as this drought continues to drag on, there's a lot of talk about what kinds of actions might we take to mitigate this drought. And, you know, part of that is water conservation. And then on the other hand, you have this idea about cloud seeding. Like, can we actually increase the amount of precipitation that's actually falling out west? And can we increase our snowpack, which is a vital freshwater resource for much of the west in that way?
I remember more than a decade ago now, I was living and reporting in Wyoming, and this story would come up a lot. And I remember, tell me if this has changed, but there was a dispute about whether or not cloud seeding even worked. Has there been any new science in that time that has cleared things up, or is it still a question mark?
There definitely has been some new science just over the past decade or so. So there was a lot of research back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, a lot of it sponsored by the federal government that, you know, was trying to figure out whether this practice really works. And it kind of hit a dead end after a while. And, you know, several decades went by. States were still engaging in this practice, but there wasn't a whole lot of hard evidence that it was really working. You know, it was one of these things where in theory it should work, but we just don't really have the evidence for it. And only over the past decade or so, and really especially in the last few years, has technology really gotten to the point where we can conduct experiments that can really provide that evidence. And that's just a factor of advanced radar technology, advancements in computer modeling. And so there have been some really interesting experiments just in the past few years. One of these in particular, back in 2017, called the Snowy Experiment, provided some of the first really concrete evidence that cloud seeding actually can increase the production of snow.
Okay, so how much snow are we talking about? Can you measure it?
So, yeah, the Snowy experiment that I just mentioned, they were able to measure the amount of snow that it seemed to produce. And over a 3-day period, kind of in this, one like mountain valley area, it produced something about, I want to say, close to 300 Olympic swimming pools worth of snow. And so okay. It sounds like a lot, you know, but if you want to think about really in the context of this ongoing drought that's been gripping the West for years, it's a pretty modest amount of snow. So the experiment showed that it can produce some snow, but the big question that remains is, you know, how much, and over a much bigger geographic area, is it going to be enough to really make a difference?
About that drought, does this speak to you how bad the problem is in the Western United States, that we'd have to resort to pumping chemicals into the clouds and kind of crossing our fingers that it will snow?
I think it does. You know, I think it speaks to this kind of growing desperation to, you know, do something about this problem, especially in the context of climate change. You know, most projections suggest that the situation is likely to continue dragging out and that droughts in the future might be even longer or more intense. And so it's really a big topic of conversation now. What can we do to try and make the situation better?
How dire is the drought right now?
The drought is pretty dire. There has been some recent research that suggests the current situation is what scientists would refer to as a mega drought. So it's a drought that lasts for many years on end. There was one recent study that suggested that the past 20 years are probably the driest period of time that the Western U.S. has experienced since at least the 1500s.
Wow. All right, Chelsea Harvey covers climate science for E&E News. Thanks very much for this story. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Today, President Biden is meeting with Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Suga is the first foreign leader Biden has invited to the White House. And for more on what's on the agenda for today, let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
So Japanese Prime Minister Suga took over from Shinzo Abe last year. What is the goal of today's summit?
The goal is to really show the cooperation between, you know, these two very important allies. Under Abe, Japan really tried to cozy up as much as possible to the former Trump administration. They were successful in some respects, but not in all of them. And obviously, there were trade issues and other things that came up. But really, these two countries have a lot that they have to try to work out when it comes to the region in Asia and what's happening there, whether it's with China or North Korea and other issues.
We are still in a pandemic, though. Why is it crucial that they meet in person? And what are some of the other reasons Biden is prioritizing Japan as the first to meet with?
I think it shows the importance of this alliance, and there is a big focus on China and trying to be somewhat of a counterweight to that, to the power of China. And so this is an administration that wants to try to say that it's looking at its allies. You know, the press secretary, Jen Psaki, was asked about why to do this in person. And basically they're saying they're not doing the dinner, they're not doing other things, they're still going to be socially distanced. But there is a difference in meeting in person versus doing it virtually. There is, there is a precedence or importance placed on, significance placed on being at the White House.
You mentioned also North Korea's nuclear program. How are they going to address that threat?
This is something that has not been resolved for decades, really, and that Japan, the U.S., as well as South Korea have been trying to put pressure on North Korea to get them to get rid of their nuclear weapons program. It has not worked. They have tried sanctions and they've tried, you know, diplomacy during the last administration, trying to meet with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. And so I think that right now the U.S. is trying to come up with a new plan, a new direction. And so part of meeting with the leader of Japan is to help solidify what that plan is going to be when it's announced, probably after Biden meets with the leader of South Korea.
And this stronger stance on China, as you mentioned, I mean, this is something that Biden has signaled is very, very important to him because we know what's happening at this moment. How does he plan to do that? What do you expect we'll hear after this meeting about what they're talking about?
Well, they're supposed to announce this $2 billion effort to develop other 5G networks that will be an alternative to the 5G network developed by Huawei, the Chinese company. Mm-hmm. So that's one big thing that they are planning to announce out of this meeting.
NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
The pandemic is not only changing the way we live our lives, it's also changing where we live them. Here's just one example. The number of people who moved to the state of Maine rose sharply last year. Many were fleeing dense urban areas, lured by the prospect of working from home in smaller towns. Maine Public Radio's Fred Bever looks at how these COVID refugees have upended the state's housing market.
There's not a lot of information yet about who moved to Maine in 2020 or how long they plan to stay, but data compiled by the Maine Realtors Association might be a good place to start. It shows that overall home sales here grew by almost 10% last year, hitting a record high of nearly 20,000 properties. And almost all the growth can be attributed to a boost in the number of buyers from other states, buyers like California native Jake Stamp.
Just looking on Zillow and everything. We actually bought it without seeing it.
Stamp and his wife, Logan Fordham, left their home on the outskirts of Silicon Valley in November, bound for this 28-acre farmstead in the rolling hills of Warren, Maine, with a swimming pond down below and a pair of resident eagles patrolling above.
It's a farmhouse built in 1841. And so it's been added on in kind of Frankenhaus over the decades, I think.
In their early 40s, the well-traveled couple had their eyes on Maine for a while. Then the pandemic nudged them to action. His company offered the remote work option, and their home in the California foothills drew some very generous offers from buyers looking to get away from the city. So the couple packed up and headed to Maine, where their real estate dollars could stretch a lot further.
Yeah, without a question. And that's, I mean, we've looked out of the country as well, and it was still, Maine was cheaper what we could get here for what we could get in Guatemala.
Most years, out-of-state buyers make up about a quarter of home sales here. Last year, it was up to a third. And new residents are putting pressure on rental markets, too. Massachusetts natives Dan Valenti and his wife Sarah really wanted to own a place in Maine, but they had to settle for a rental.
Because we couldn't find any housing. I had driven up and I had flown up a number of times just to look at some possible opportunities, and they really didn't materialize into anything. It's really a competitive market.
But while house hunting may be stressful, some see what might be growing pains, a signal that Maine's population, long in a state of decline, may be on the rise.
Every year there are more deaths than births in the state. So we're completely reliant on migration for our population growth.
State economist Amanda Rector says that over the last decade, Maine's aging population has grown at an anemic rate, just above 1%. She says it's possible Maine's increased migration could help offset some demographic challenges.
This sort of little bit of a silver lining in terms of perhaps this is an opportunity for Maine to start seeing some increased migration.
Anecdotal evidence of surging school enrollments lends credence to the idea. The Secretary of State's office also recorded more than 80,000 new-to-Maine voter registrations in 2020. But the hard data needed to draw firm conclusions about population growth and demographics just aren't there yet, Rector says. That's partly because pandemic-driven dislocations have made even official numbers difficult to gather and interpret. Rector warns that there is a potential downside to the recent dynamics, with out-of-state dollars sending housing costs to new highs. Some Mainers could get priced out.
The people who may be looking for a home who were renting or are sort of newly established households within the state are now competing with a much larger pool of people for those limited houses. And so it has the potential to really drive up some of the housing unaffordability that was already a problem in some places.
Real estate agents say they see it happening. Rob Edgerly, an agent who compiles an annual hottest towns in Maine list, says the squeeze is on not just for primary residences, but also for the vacation homes and camps that many Mainers desire.
You know, are you going to be able to go up to camp or buy up camp? It's going to be tougher because those areas all saw big spikes.
Back at their farmstead in Warren, Jake Stamp and Logan Fordham say they get it.
Oh, yeah. Things have doubled in price.
Well, that's why
since
we came
4 years ago.
Is because, and I mean, I do understand the concerns that people here have. Like, all of a sudden they're seeing things get out of reach and then we show up.
Stamp vows, though, that they are not planning to flip their house. His plan is to settle down and become a true New Englander.
Well, I'll always be from away, right? So, yeah, but but as much as they'll let me, yeah.
For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever in Portland, Maine.
More than 600 American cities have streets named after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And now, after several years of debate, Kansas City rejoins the list. This week, the city's Parks and Recreation Board of Commissioners voted to rename a large section of two parkways after the civil rights leader. The decision comes after residents 2 years ago voted to remove King's name from a well-known boulevard in the city. Let's bring in reporter Luke Martin from member station KCUR. And Luke, the city first honored Dr. King with a street named after him in 2019, as I mentioned, but voters overturned that decision. Remind us what happened.
Yeah, that vote was an overwhelming one. 70% of Kansas City voters decided to reject the city council's attempt to rename the Paseo for Martin Luther King Jr. And so, the city was put in this position where they had to take down Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard signs that had already been mounted and remount ones that said the Paseo. More recently, Mayor Quentin Lucas, who actually lives on the Paseo himself, asked the Kansas City Parks Board to start gathering community ideas for how we could honor Martin Luther King Jr. The Parks Board said they got 600 ideas, of course, after that original vote was overturned.
CMO Parks Commissioner Chris Good, who is Black, spoke with KCUR about why this is more than just a street naming. Let's listen.
It was 53 years ago that Dr. King was slain. Yes. It was murdered. His blood laid in a pool on a balcony. This isn't just this green piece of material that will adorn our boulevard. This is a moment for us to come alongside of each other.
Can you give us insight, though, into why there was that initial opposition to rename Paseo after MLK?
Absolutely. So, you know, members of the Black clergy here in Kansas City had really been working for decades to try and find a street that we could name after Martin Luther King Jr. They landed on this idea of the Paseo in January of 2016. What had to happen, though, was the city council had to bypass a requirement that said the majority of people living on the street had to approve of the change. The council bypassed this requirement, and that naturally caused some controversy. So people who wanted to reverse the name change said that, one, the Paseo has some historical significance here in Kansas City. It's the oldest boulevard in town. And they said that the council just did not do a good enough job informing residents that the change was going to happen.
This is also a symbolic change. It's really speaking to the coming together of two neighborhoods. Describe these two parkways and the neighborhoods they run through. Who are the residents and who live there?
Sure. So the Paseo, at its creation, it was kind of the wealthy part of Kansas City, and you had a lot of very wealthy white residents who lived around that boulevard. In the ensuing decades, Kansas City became very racially segregated, and that area of town really fell on the wrong side of the red line here in Kansas City. And now it is really the backbone of the black community here in Kansas City. The new Martin Luther King route is very different. It is not a residential neighborhood at all. It's kind of anchored on the west end by Kansas City's ritziest outdoor mall, the Country Club Plaza. You have a public library. You have the University of Missouri, Kansas City there as well. And just across the creek, you have the Nelson Atkins Museum, which is, you know, one of Kansas City's crown jewels. But it is much more commercial and cultural as you go down that new Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
That's KCUR reporter Luke Martin talking with us today about the city voting to rename a street after Martin Luther King Jr. Luke, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
If you were a baseball fan 40 years ago, you're bound to remember Fernando Mania. Pitcher Fernando Valenzuela became a pop culture icon overnight when he made his debut with the LA Dodgers in April of 1981.
Fastball popped in the air, foul. Garvey, I think, has a play. And Fernando has his fifth shutout. Unbelievable.
Fans adored the portly pitcher from Sonora, Mexico. They lined up at Dodger Stadium to watch him play. He captured the zeitgeist of the 1980s, and decades later, he remains a Mexican-American icon. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he's part of the paper's Fernando Mania at 40 documentary. Gustavo, welcome.
Gracias for having me.
So one of the things I remember about Fernando Valenzuela being a Dodgers fan in the 1980s was his windup, the way he pulled his leg up into his chest and then he looked to the sky before delivering his pitch. What was it about that captivated people?
It was just so dramatic. I mean, everything. Like, first you have his, he would have his arms just like almost in prayer, right around, like around his belly, I would say, not too high up on the chest or on the waist. Then he pulls up like as high up as possible, hands up in the air, eyes up in the air. Then, since he's a left-hander, you know, we know in baseball, left-handers are always seen as a little bit weird, like an exotic species. So he would just fling his arm back as far back as possible. And then just with this explosive delivery to home plate, and of course his signature pitch was a screwball, which is a pitch that very few pitchers ever try to master because it literally wrecks your arm over the course of your career. But Fernando, for those first couple of years, it was like he was like Zeus throwing thunderbolts down to home plate and just slaying all the competition.
You know, I remember practicing that windup, trying to mimic it the best I could in the backyard with my friends, and I guess you did too.
I can only speak as a Mexican-American, as a child of Mexican immigrants growing up in Southern California during the 80s, but it turned out more than just Mexicans. But for us, it was like communion. It was a ritual that you would do. Like our uncles and our dads would tell us, "Pitcha como Fernando," like try to like show us how Fernando pitches. Do it just like Fernando. And so we would have these competitions to see who could throw up their arms as high as possible or roll back their eyes up to heaven as much as possible and just do it. And it didn't matter if you're a left-hander or a right-hander, you had your Fernando delivery.
So Fernando had his first start for the Dodgers in April of 1981, 40 years ago. It was a shutout win against the Astros. And I think it's fair to say that that was the moment that pretty much marked the start of what became known as Fernando Mania. And for people who don't remember that, or it's, you know, it's been a while, How wild was L.A. for Fernando Valenzuela?
Nothing has been like this in sports ever since. Not LeBron coming into town, not Kobe as a 19-year-old, not even Pedro Martinez when he showed up in Boston from the Expos and just started destroying the competition. No, you have to put it in its context. Here you have in the early 80s, Mexicans are starting to become the biggest minority group, or, you know, one of the biggest group, period, in Southern California. But they're still kind of seen as, like, you know, strangers in a land that used to be theirs. You have the Dodgers begging, you know, haven't won the World Series since 1965 with Sandy Koufax. Mm-hmm. You have and also you have a team that still hasn't really been embraced by the Chicanos, the Mexican-Americans who had been in Southern California for decades, if not generations. And here you have this rookie straight from Mexico, from northern Mexico, a state called Sonora, pudgy. You know, he looks like your uncle. He looks like your tio Ezequiel or your tio Santos.
He wore big, thick glasses, too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, the good old bomber glasses from the back in the days. Exactly. And this was not a case of just affirmative action. This is not a case like, oh, you know, he's good for a Mexican. No, this is a guy who is the best in baseball. Everyone falls in love, but specifically for Mexican-Americans, we take him to heart more than anyone, because for the first time in maybe ever in the United States, everyone wants to be a Mexican.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to some old archival tape here. This is legendary Dodgers broadcaster Vin Scully, who has described the frenzy around Valenzuela as a religious experience. This is May 8th, 1981, and Valenzuela was about to put the finishing touches on a seven-hit shutout against the Mets.
And once again, a large crowd has come out full of the question, is he for real? And once again, the large crowd is one inning away from getting another shocking answer.
So it has been 40 years now, and I even still get goosebumps when we're talking about him. Why do you think that people still care about Fernando Valenzuela and still pine for those years after all this time?
Most importantly, because he was a winner. Again, he was the best of the best that year. Cy Young Award winner, Rookie of the Year, also won the World Series championship. Then more importantly for Mexican-Americans, we have not had a Mexican who has been as popular among the rest of the United States ever since. And, you know, there's like this pining that Mexican-Americans want to go back to that promised land. But I've always been skeptical of saviors. So, I ended my column by saying, no, the salvation was us. We were the ones who are really, you know, we have to look within ourselves to be as confident as we are today in navigating the United States.
Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks very much for speaking to us about this icon in baseball. We appreciate it.
Gracias for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.